to the partners for being here. We are back continuing with our meeting, and also would want to welcome Dr. Vela, which was not here yesterday, I think. Members, we actually got to, I think, the second point, second priority, which was skills development with particular focus on those areas. And also, Member Vukuza, welcome back. I did advise you to rather stay in South Africa. I'll not say why. The last three priorities really speaks to quality improvement, health, education, institutional development. But I would want to advise members that we go through that. We then will have to deal with it. Just the critical challenges, I think, that the department is confronted with, and then immediately the financials. So over to members under quality improvement. Any issues to be raised there? I think we spent quite a little bit of time yesterday on the poverty as well as the skills development side. Member? Just put the mic on, please.
There you are. Mr. Hendra, under the heading inclusive education, you made the remark that this area still bugs you, and I'm sure it bugs all of us. Under the first bullet in your presentation, you referred to an investigation conducted in provinces to determine the implementation of inclusive education. Have you completed this investigation? If so, what were the results, or are you still busy? Will you please give us more information regarding this investigation, and was the decision of inclusive education to include learners with special needs into the mainstream the right decision? Then I've got another shorter question on systemic education. You remarked that the results are still low, but that the department is on the right track. What still has to be done to improve results to a satisfactory level?
Can we add on that then? What is the three or four fundamental issues? Why are we not getting the quality of education that we, even if all these achievements have been met, but we're not getting to the quality education? I think there's a lot of analysis done on that issue. Any other member on priority three? If not, then I'll get reply.
Thanks, Chairperson, and good morning to honourable members. A pleasure to be here once again, and as you said, joined by Dr. Kubela, our DDG for Higher Education in the department. Chair, on these two questions, I think inclusive education, we must recall, of course, that White Paper 6 set itself a target of 2020. So we always knew that this was going to be a big and a long road that we were going to have to travel to satisfactorily deal with all learners who had special needs of any sort, so we recognized that in the first place. The question about mainstreaming, as to whether it's the right policy or not, well, you know, I think different people might have different views on that. There's certainly different experience internationally. Some countries have moved towards mainstreaming. Others have tended to stay more with special facilities for special needs learners. I think we certainly accepted in the first instance a very strong push towards mainstreaming, and that was our large focus. We were trying to ensure that children who could be mainstreamed into public ordinary schools should be. We put a lot of time and effort into that. We built capacity within those schools themselves. We built these district support teams to support schools who were trying to do this. And I would still say, I think in broad terms, it is the correct policy that children who can be taught together with ordinary learners without special needs, it is right that they go into those mainstream schools and get taught there. But I think what we did recognize is that after the first 5 years or so of that white paper and the policy being pursued, that in a way there were gaps being left. And those gaps, in a way, were the former special schools that we had, And the evidence very strongly showed, and perhaps hinted at in the investigation itself, that in some cases these special needs facilities were themselves being neglected in favor of the mainstreaming approach. So what I think we have now is a bit of a hybrid, a bit of a combination, which says mainstreaming is still undoubtedly our preferred policy, and wherever possible, learners should be mainstreamed into public ordinary schools. But in the past 2 or 3 years, we have recognized at the same time the need to invest very heavily, continue to invest heavily in our special needs schools. There are some learners who simply have to have those particular facilities, assistive devices, additional support staff, etc. And we have, I think in the last while, seen those institutions once again being pulled back. Not perhaps to the level that they would like, and I know that the Human Rights Commission is still inundated with requests from those schools for additional facilities and resources. We, of course, have to balance them across the system, so there's still a challenge in that regard. But I would say that I think our policy position and the adjustments that have been made with it in the last while are certainly the right policy for this country at this time, and we should continue to pursue them. The investigation, yes, has been completed, and I can provide you with a copy of that. I'm not going to try and summarize it now, except to say that I think the evidence is uneven. There are provinces, certainly, that have invested properly in these independent, these special schools and have seen them provided with additional facilities. There were some, certainly, in the poorer provinces who really were in a severe state of neglect. And that's why these steps we took around the national tender and those sort of things around assistive devices, we ourselves have done some buying in that, trying to compensate at least for where those problems have existed. But as I say, we can certainly share that report with you, and I think it would be good for honourable members, again, as part of their visits, to ensure that they do include these special schools in their visits. But we would invite you also to go perhaps and visit some of these full-service schools now, which are accommodating learners with special needs. Let's go and see what is happening in those schools as well, and whether we are giving those children a proper deal, as it were. On the systemic evaluation, we have published, of course, the reports of those evaluations that have been conducted, and they have, I think, proved very useful, not just for us at a national level, but they've been reflected back down to a provincial and even to a district level for individuals to look at what's happening within their institutions and try and learn from that and benefit from it. I think the two, you asked the question, what still has to be done, and Chairperson, you're asking that as well. I think we've seen two things that have to be done. One is greater clarity from the department about what we expect on a daily basis. And I think we've done that in two areas. One, of course, is the Foundations for Learning that I spoke about yesterday. Ask any teacher, you know, dealing with grades 1 to 6 about the Foundations for Learning program. They will tell you it's the best thing that has happened to them in the last 10 or 15 years. So there's no doubt that direction, that guidance that has been given is critical. I can tell you also that we are working on these workbooks now that will be delivered at the beginning of 2010 to all our grade 1 to 6 learners as well. These workbooks have been written by ourselves to correlate with the lesson plans that we've now prepared and given to teachers. So every teacher from grade 1 to 6 is going to get a set of lesson plans that says this is what you need for the year and this is, you know, how we're going to see it work through. Children will get a workbook in their own hands, one for literacy, one for numeracy, that will follow exactly those lesson plans, so there's no ambiguity about what we should be doing today or next week or whatever. So it's that sort of guidance and direction, I think, that we're giving to teachers that all the evidence has told us is the most cost-effective way of producing quality improvements, particularly at that level. So I think we're seeing that on a broader level. We're seeing it also last week, of course, on Friday, the Minister announced the outcomes of the curriculum implementation review that has been conducted. Not a review of the curriculum, we're stressing that. It's simply a review of the implementation of that curriculum and to ask about any impediments that might be faced in terms of delivering that curriculum effectively. Of course, the major response from teachers was about administrative workload, assessment workload, those kind of things. The Minister has announced a sweeping set of dramatic changes, quite honestly, that will change the face of teaching, and some of these will even come into effect from next year, that will just allow teachers in the end to spend more time teaching and less time administering that teaching, even in the form of assessment, etc. So I think that sort of clarity is the one leg that we have moved on very strongly in the last while. The second is what we launched last year, which is the Quality Learning and Teaching Campaign. Based on the statements of the President that has said education is not just a job of the Department of Education, it's not the job even of government, it is a societal matter. The Quality Learning and Teaching Campaign is precisely designed to turn education into a societal matter. And under the Quality Learning and Teaching Campaign, we have brought in as partners now all the teacher unions, school governing bodies, community representatives, student leaders, student formations, etc. And everyone in terms of the non-negotiables has made their commitment around what they will be doing to ensure quality education. I think, Chair, this is very much part of building up public expectations around what is needed. I've often joked with the unions and said, you know, if you think we're setting up an inspectorate and you're scared of that, wait for the old lady down the road when she hears that you're supposed to have been at school until 3 o'clock every afternoon and you haven't been. You've got much more to fear from her than any inspectorate, yeah? Mm. And that's partly what it's about. It's about building that community expectation that this is what should happen in a good school, this is the way we're going to achieve quality, and we're around to play their part. I'm pleased to say, Chair, that just this week we've seconded five people into the department, some of them union leaders, some from other partner organizations, and they will be constituting the driving force of this Quality Learning and Teaching Campaign. And really, I think we would want to invoke the support of the honorable members here to see any opportunity we can to get this campaign grounded in our schools. One of the little things we are doing, well, two of the things we're doing, one is we set up an SMS line with the help of MTN, so that anyone who's picking up issues at a particular school is able to just SMS them to this line, and this grouping will deal with them. But the other is we're contemplating some sort of notion of a badge, an award of some sort that schools will get that says we're a quality school or some sort. There's a nice little badge that goes outside their school in some way that says we've met these requirements, being on time, in class, prepared, children doing their homework, parents playing a role, supporting and that sort of thing. You meet all those criteria, you will get either the flag to fly or whatever it might be that says we're a quality school. So I think it's going to be something over the next while that we will see quite dramatically change the terrain of it. So those would be our two approaches, I think, to improving quality, Chair. I don't know if there are any additions from anyone else. Hmm?
Thank you. Just before that, who's heading the campaign, say, at the head office?
Ms. Carlson, I think it is your job, although we have now appointed a project manager within the office, but Ms. Carlson, maybe you just want to elaborate?
Thank you, Chair. At the outset, I was asked to coordinate the launch of the campaign, which we then did in October, but obviously the campaign needs to go beyond just the rhetoric and the photo opportunity. So it's taken a steady and slow pace of growing the campaign, first of all in terms of the union's complete buy-in to it, and we have that in the form of a steering committee comprising the principals of each of these unions who on a regular basis meet to plan the campaign. An operational plan has been developed, a business plan. Funding has been secured through the ELRC because this was campaign, first of all, initiated on good faith rather than an actual budget. And we've seen that our business breakfast that we held just about a month ago has brought a number of the business stakeholders on board to begin to support the campaign in practical terms, like the MTN one and others we've seen. We've had a number of requests to look at supporting the quality status in schools, and that will be taking off in the next for the remainder of this quarter. And we're looking at 2010 as being the official relaunch of the campaign on a far more serious level in support of the presidency's planning and M&E initiatives in schools. So I'm very optimistic that we've got that we have these units on board now. We also have worked with our district officials in informing them of the campaign, and we want to ensure that each of the provinces launch a similar, some of them have already launched the campaign and have taken them down to district level, in fact. And that is our next aim, so that we can, you know, begin to cascade what is intended through the campaign to all levels in support from the department side, as well as to grow community awareness around this. Thank you.
Co-chair. Honourable member.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry for coming. The traffic was you're going to have it this morning. What would be the rationale for involving unions in this campaign? You know, it strikes me that she says they inform district officials, but when it comes to unions, they'll urge them to buy in into this program. Because I want to argue, you know, one of the hindrances to achieving this quality education is what unions are doing outside there. You see, that's my argument.
Please also give the assurance to that honourable member that the department is not being controlled by unions.
No. I understand that. That's why I'm asking why the department, what rationale would they have in involving the unions and even wanting the unions to buy into this? And district officials, when it comes to district officials, you know, it's just informing them, you know.
Thank you, Chair. I think the former education minister was very, very wise when she invited all of these stakeholders to that meeting where this particular campaign was initiated. I think if we go back to the fact that non-negotiables require teachers to be on class, in class on time and on task, we need to acknowledge the existence of this very critical stakeholder out there in the schools. Now, if we as the department exercise all of the will in the world, it's not really going to be practicalized unless we have complete buy-in from that critical stakeholder. So I acknowledge, I think the honorable member is correct in saying that a number of these union members could possibly be the ones that will violate the very aims of the campaign, but we've seen a consistent effort on the part of all of these unions. I have addressed platforms, the DG has, and many other members of the department have had opportunity to address members, ordinary members of these unions, and teachers themselves who have committed to this process. I think in time we will see this grow. There has certainly been a commitment from leadership, and in all of their particular newsletters and platforms that they have access to, they've promoted this campaign even more vigorously in some cases than our officials in provinces. So I must say that we certainly don't see ourselves being able to run this campaign solely as departmental officials. We are partners out there in the schools, and those sites become contested sites unless we make sure that everybody buys into this campaign. And with the President's message being loud and clear when he addressed principals, I didn't hear a single principal on that day challenge the notion that this should be a campaign based on a solid foundation of the partnership around these issues.
Honourable Member Smile.
Thank you, Chair. With due respect to the department's position on the buy-in of the unions, Chairperson, there's one critical question. It's the departmental officials that will do the monitoring and evaluation of the project. It's not the unions. So then it is the officials and the school teachers that must do the work. So the department then to have a buy-in from the union. If they do not buy in, then we have a problem. So I would then say, based on what should be done in terms of monitoring and evaluation, it is the school inspectors that must get the information, take to the teacher in the classroom. This is what you will be doing for this quarter. I'll come back in the next quarter and see whether it's done. That's the usual thing. It should be like that. Simple.
Honourable Member Mishwana.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to come in and perhaps try to, I don't know whether to negotiate a position with the members here, that it's excellent to have the unions involved. Because once they are involved, they own the process. And there is no educator. The last time I checked, there is no educator who does not belong to a particular union. So that if you leave them out, if you leave the unions out, they are leaving the educators out. So that instead of being scared of what they would do, perhaps we need to give them the benefit of the doubt, because most of the changes that happened is because of what the unions did. Fortunately, I was both a union and an inspector. Thank you.
Honourable Member Jones. Thank you, Chairperson. there is a form called Form 450, which teachers have to complete each time learners have failed in his or her class. And this form creates a lot of problems for teachers. It causes them stress, because you've got to complete a form for each and every child explaining as to why the child has failed. And it also encourages teachers to commit fraud, because they then get tired of completing these forms and pass all children so that they don't have a nightmare of having to complete this form. I want to find out if this form is still in use, because it really doesn't serve the purpose. Secondly, there is also what is called the IQMS. This IQMS is intended to assess educators' performance. The educator is assessed by a peer and by an official, and if the educator has satisfied the requirements, then he or she would get 1% increase. And the educator has to indicate the areas where he or she is lacking and would want to be improved. But teachers keep on completing this form and indicating their weaknesses where they want to be improved, and there's no follow-up, they don't get improved, and this happens year in and year out. Is this actually going to come to an area where we can say then this form is not serving the purpose and it must come to an end, or is the department intending to now begin to improve teachers where they are lacking so that this form serves the purpose it is intended for? Thank you.
There's a lot. I'm noting, I think, Member Jenny, your hand was up. Okay. Ahetra and James, that's the last one.
Thanks, Chair. Let me apologize for being late. I got stuck in the Chief Whip's office.
That's not a good thing.
Let me start by saying that the trade union movement is a serious stakeholder, and I would love to advise my fellow members that they must improve on that. Secondly,
protection, Mr. Chair. You need to be protected.
Secondly, you are talking about quality improvement. I want to relate this to this house, that racism is rising in a certain Khartoum Liar school in the Northern Cape province. Last week, the mother of a child, grade 5, called me to say the grade 5 learners have been suspended. When they want to find reasons, there are no reasons, just misconduct. So I talked to the principal, I talked to the school inspector, I talked to the Department of Education in the Northern Cape. Then the suspension were uplifted, but as I'm talking now, the school principal, Mr. Van Niekerk, is adamant that these kids must go home. They are black learners. The second incident that I got is that a white learner stabbed a black learner in that school, and the black learner has been expelled from that school. So I don't know how these campaigns are working. The department needs to deal with the situation and respond to that. I thank you, Chairperson.
The last person on this matter.
I just wanted to say that the trade unions have played a powerful role in obtaining rights for people working in particular professions, and that ought to be acknowledged, obviously, and also admired, because in the history of this country there has been the segregation of rights in a way that was highly undesirable. So the question we must always ask is whether trade unions in their action day-to-day are serving the best interests of learners. That question must always be asked, because I know in my own personal experience that they don't always do that. It's important not to generalize on this issue. It's important to ask the question every time, and for us, therefore, to keep vigilance in terms of... I mean, it's natural for trade unions to look after its members. There's nothing evil about it. But the question is whether there's a conflict, and whether we are vigilant to that conflict and managing that conflict. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the very interesting, I think, inputs there. Perhaps I should just make it clear. This quality learning and teaching campaign is in no way displacing your normal departmental procedures. So in terms of monitoring, evaluation, work that's being done in the school, that is undeniably the work of the department, district managers, etc., visiting schools. Those must all continue. There's no displacement of that. This is around the social mobilization, in a way, to make sure that those departmental processes are indeed happening. Are the district managers visiting the schools? Let's ask community leaders. When was your school last visited? When did your school last call a parents' meeting? Those sort of questions, I think, are the ones that we're asking under the QLTC, and certainly the same, not just basing it. And, Chair, perhaps just in relation to the comments about the unions, and I don't think anyone is going to deny, firstly, that there are different unions which have perhaps different dynamics, but also that unions have been perceived, and perhaps in some cases rightly perceived, as having been obstacles to change in this country. But I really would invite people to keep their eyes and ears on the ground in this regard, and in particular, perhaps, if you can get a copy of the recent speech that the President of SADCU delivered to his National General Council. I have never heard personally such a dramatic, not shift, because I think the union has always said they have a professional leg, but a dramatic statement of that professional leg, where the President of SADCU was quite unambiguously saying that in order to be a revolutionary in this time, there's a couple of things you need to do, and that is to be first in that classroom and last out of that classroom. That's about an educational revolutionary in this day and age. And he was making that strong, extremely strong statement to this leadership of the union, some of whom I think were probably a bit uncomfortable with it. But that message is coming out loud and clear. And then we also say, with some of the disruptions or potential disruptions in the Gauteng area, and Soweto in particular, you would have seen there the national office of that union has been quite unambiguous in condemning that kind of action. It has said we are not supporting these kind of things, and effectively said to those members, you get back into school and don't leave your school. So I think we mustn't just think about what might have been, but in a sense what is prevailing at this stage. And I think you'll find from all the unions this extremely strong statement about the need for quality, certainly. Mr. Bonanno, I'm not sure about Form 450. I'll have to check on that one. I'm not aware of anything nationally. It might be a provincial form. Perhaps let us have a copy of that. I will try and find out what that is about. But on the question, and maybe it's one of the things that has been dealt with in this curriculum implementation review. If that's one of the administrative burdens that is preventing people from getting quality teaching happening, then hopefully it's one of those things that would have been pulled back from this review process. On the IQMS, Mr. Norma rightly says it's about initially peer evaluation, self-evaluation, etc. But let's not lose sight of the fact that we have nearly 100 now IQMS moderators appointed. These are people who had been in education, either school principals or whatever, who have now retired largely, and we brought them back as IQMS moderators. So they are going school to school in a way to check on the quality of these internal moderations. So the idea that now it's just a chummy-chummy thing, I'll give you 100, you give me 100, and we'll each get our notch, cannot apply anymore. Certainly any schools in particular that are showing perhaps an absence of a spread of marks in some way will be inviting these moderators to come and check on the IQ-earning process in that school, and I think we should understand the credibility of these results is improving, certainly, and these moderators also providing us with some fascinating information about schools, about how they're working and their operation. And, of course, they still do confront one or two situations where they get to a school and the school says, oh, no, you can't come in here. Clearly, provinces have been following up with those kind of things, so it is there. The point Mr. Mnama raises about the follow-up to IQMS is critical. If you're identifying your development needs, is there some plan to address those? Well, that came up very strongly at the Teacher Development Summit, which we hosted recently in September, a very good summit, and much of that work is now being processed as a consequence of that summit, and I think we will see a much stronger focus on teacher development and the links with areas like IQMS over the next while, certainly, as I say, once that CPTD process is established. The issue of racism, obviously, is still one that plagues us across the country, and thanks for raising it. I obviously don't know anything about those two cases. I would ask you, please, to follow it up, certainly initially with the provincial department, and make sure that they are dealing with it and are dealing with it properly. If you feel that that is not achieving what you want, happily, of course, bring it to us at the national department, or if you feel appropriate, perhaps the Human Rights Commission might also be invited to look into that kind of instance. But we would certainly follow up any case that was brought to our attention around that. I think those were the questions here. We would note the comments, I think, of Honourable James.
Can we? I really don't want to go back to these issues. Unless it is a new issue on this topic, otherwise, on this page, otherwise I'm not going to allow it. Can we comply? This is the third time that I allow you to speak in this one. Is it a new issue?
Yes.
Okay.
It's on awarding of tenders. I see that the supply of school material, whatever form, is closely linked to achieving quality education in schools. Now, my question is, the department, is there any way where the department does monitor the awarding of tenders by provinces to this service provider? Because in one province, for instance, up to now as we're talking.
Can I ask that we leave that under the financial and the accountability and the monitoring mechanisms related to it? I understand the link, the subtle link that you are smuggling in, Honourable Member, around quality improvement on it. But can we are getting there, so let's deal with it there. Can we move to the next priority, which is health education? Anyone on that? Honourable Co-Chair.
Okay. I just wanted to, and perhaps a question that kind of also straddles many other categories, but on the issue of screening, health screening in schools, I've become aware of the fact that in certain provinces in particular, there are enormous problems with just very basic health issues. On the one hand, you know, we're very focused on school nutrition, rightly so, and I think that that's a very commendable thing. But it doesn't help if you don't get basic screening back in schools. So you have a child who's not hungry, but equally is suffering from a very basic ailment that really thwarts the ability to learn. And I'm not quite sure why we don't focus on a national policy around screening of kids at a very basic level, initially eyes, ears, and so on. But also, when we talk about screening, I wonder to what extent we're talking about schooling that is integrated. I wonder to what extent we screen for basic cognitive development. So if a child is dyslexic, for example, do we pick it up early enough in a school to be able to identify the special needs of this child? I think that those things become quite critical if we look at the priority of improving quality. Because quality, you know, can mean many things to many people. But for me, it's every one of us learns differently. Some people learn better by through their vision, and those are quite academically inclined people. Then you have people who learn because they hear things better, and then others learn through doing things. So, and when it comes to dyslexic children, children who have other kind of learning, I don't want to say disabilities, but who learn differently. All of us learn differently, and some just learn more differently than others. And we try and package them into this schooling system that has blackboard, chalk, book. A child is dyslexic, is not going to cope in that environment. And we don't have that kind of... I'm wondering to what extent we're looking in the future towards that kind of screen.
Anyone else on this matter? Honorable Member Mishrana.
Yeah, thank you. Perhaps so that the department can answer, including what I want to say concerning kids who have serious challenges. And I link it to what was said, I think, yesterday about people having matric to go to FET. And to say that definitely we need to accept that there are kids who may never get the matric in their life, kids who cannot even read and write, that kids will grow up to be human beings who would like to go and work somewhere. So those kids will need skills, and the skills will definitely come from education. So we look at to the Department of Education for that. And perhaps the proposal that one can give, because sometimes you come with a problem and you leave it open, is that there is something called a production school outside, somewhere, not in South Africa. And in a production school, you are taught to do things with your hands. You are given a diploma for that, and you work so that you take care of your family or whatever. Or taking, if the Department of Education can take care of those people who cannot read and write. Because not everybody must get matric, and everybody must become a doctor and a professor, but people can just work. I thank you.
In this, how far is the link between sports and especially the Department of Sport and Culture? Or recreation, and then yourselves in terms of the alignment around sports and schools. I'm noting another end. Member Kupai.
Thanks, Chair. Apologies for arriving late. I had another meeting. Firstly, Chair, I just wanted to understand from the DG on the issue of infrastructure in schools. Did we have a target of either building libraries or improving? And what was the target, and have we met those targets? If not, why didn't we meet the target? Thanks.
Does it fall under this heading? Can I ask a question on things? A few weeks ago, the Portfolio Committee was given a report, a full report on teenage pregnancies. And it was mentioned that these mothers are invited back to educate, to the system. And knowing that they are sexually active, my question was, how does that affect the other learners? Now, the person who presented the report stated that it was not based on a national research project or empirical information, but merely on a literacy study. Is the department planning a full research project on this very crucial issue? And then I just want to add to Ms. Fatima Chohan's question regarding learning theories. I should think that we should include this matter in the syllabi for teachers' training colleges, for the training of teachers. It's very important. Learning theories. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we get his responses?
You can
I invite Mr. Ndebele, who's responsible for both health and sports issues, to comment on those questions first time.
Thank you, DG. First, in relation to the screening testing, the honourable member is right. We initially had what we called Latin Bilo campaigns, which were programs that we took to different provinces, but they were very irregular and not structured. But as part of the plan for next year, we are going to be starting with screening for grades R and grade 1 in quintile 1 schools, and it's primarily a resource issue, both financial and capacity issue. We're working with the Department of Health, and we prioritize in the 18 priority areas that are identified by the Department of Health, because there they have got field nurses that are working. And we've identified teeth, eyes, deworming, and ears initially. And as part of the process, each of the children will have then a comprehensive card that they will use as they proceed through the system, and we're working with Lorit to make sure that the information of the learners is accurate. So there are plans to institutionalize screening. By the end of the financial year, we will have done all grade ones, grade R and grade ones in quintile one schools. We had submitted a bid to the Treasury for this area. Unfortunately, it was not passed. However, between ourselves and the Department of Health, and we've now partnered with Pelo Paper, the train, Transnet train, we believe that we'll be able to at least do quintile one schools, grade R and one for the year. So it's something that we seriously have in our plans for next year. In terms of the teenage pregnancy, the study that was presented looks at literature. There's been so many studies that have been done on this matter, and the study looked at literature. However, we believe that if there are any things that are arising out of the study that need further research, we will do that. But primarily, we would like to focus on ensuring that the recommendations of the study are implemented. The document is now going to Cabinet for presentation, and as I reported earlier, we will come back to the Portfolio Committee with a plan, because we've finalized our consultations on the document. The link between SRSA, we're working jointly with them. We have a joint calendar for school sports that we're implementing. It still has challenges, and last year SRSA had financial constraints, and they were unable to fund some of the activities. But we're now finalizing a policy, which we're doing jointly with them and the Federation on school sports, that we will present when we're ready with it.
Chair, can I just add then? I think we should clarify, you mentioned the pregnancy issue in relation to a literacy report. Now, that was the data that came out of the Pearls report a year or so ago, I think. But what Mr. Nabeer is referring to, of course, is a very recent report done by the HSRC, and that is specifically on learner pregnancies. It's not part of a literacy study or anything. So that's a very dedicated report on this issue, and I think some fascinating findings, one of them of which is that clear evidence that the sooner you can get a mother back into school, the better chance you have of preventing a second pregnancy. So you're asking about the effect on the other learners, and perhaps that's a different question, but certainly for the individual child, the benefits of getting back into school are undoubtedly good for them. So I think we must recognize that. Just working backwards through them, Chair, I think the issue of learning theories indeed is dealt with in teacher training programs. Perhaps we could speak to the deans of the faculties of education and just check to what extent that is the case, but certainly we would assume that people are told about ways of learning and they'd be sensitive to that. But let me also say then, in response perhaps to the co-chair, I'm not sure that we've cracked that entirely. Obviously, within a system as large as ours and perhaps as under-resourced as ours, inevitably we're going to focus perhaps on the bigger, more general picture, and that individual child is probably going to be lost, certainly where your class sizes are bigger than you'd like, etc. That's going to be a concern. We have developed an instrument called SIAS. It's FIAS, Screening, Identification, and Support. That's meant to assist. The difficulty is you have very few remedial teachers really in the system, so you're depending on ordinary classroom teachers to be able to identify these problems and issues, and most of them are clearly not specialists. They might have encountered it to a certain extent in their training, but they certainly wouldn't be able to draw fine distinctions about different pathologies, etc. So this instrument is meant to be in the hands of ordinary teachers to say, look, if the child demonstrates these kind of behaviors, possibly this is what's causing it, and you know, then either refer it or deal with it this way or whatever. So trying to help teachers understand that issue and identify those who do then need remedial work of some sort, but I would have to acknowledge we don't have a system broadly of screening around those remedial needs, and probably as much as the health needs, those would be areas we have to deal with. On the issue of the, you speak about the production school, look, I think it's linked to the whole issue of guidance within schools, both guidance in terms of subject choices, for example, that people are taking in schools, but guidance more broadly, should I leave school, go to an FPT college, that kind of question. And again, we would probably have to say that we don't believe this is adequately done in all our schools. Guidance is now, in fact, one of the priority areas for the Funzulu-Shaka bursaries. So we are striving to get more guidance teachers into schools that can provide that kind of support for learners. Clearly, it's an important one. Look, I'm not sure what is meant by this production school. I mentioned yesterday we are trying to build around the technical high schools, but I would be very cautious about suggesting that anyone should perhaps not be getting a matric. I think we need to accept that matric is a basic minimum qualification that everybody should get. There are different types of matric, and you can get a matric with technical subjects, that's fine, but all the evidence is showing that 12 years of schooling certainly makes an enormous difference to all sorts of life chances thereafter, and I would hate to be telling a child at an early age that you're not likely to get a matric. I think you should go to a production school, something like that. Our notion is you learn technology and technical skills, but you do that together with some of the fundamentals of communication, language, numeracy, etc. Very often, you know, production school could very often be the old kind of model where someone is trained into a particular job, and then for 40 years, the rest of their life, they work in that particular job. We cannot confine people. We need to train them in a way that allows them to continue a lifelong development in those different ways. So that's what we'd like to push. On the issue of libraries, I can't say that there are particular targets. Libraries would just be part of our broader investment in infrastructure and schools. I'm going to just invite Mr. Patel perhaps just to comment on it. He deals with issues of infrastructure broadly in our school.
Thank you, Deji and Chair. I think due to the vast backlogs in school infrastructure, there has been no specific provision for specialist facilities in the year under review, that is in 2008-09 financial year. However, for this particular financial year, provinces have targeted 159 schools for library facilities. For the 2010-11, 11-12 and 12-13 years, we have been successful through the national process in accessing funds in the 2009 medium-term budget policy statement to focus on special facilities such as libraries, laboratories, sports facilities, security, and so forth. Over this period, provinces have targeted 3,820 schools for full provisioning of libraries as well as for specialist facilities construction.
Just say that we visited Kian, and there is a facility being managed by the department. It's a district, I think it's a district facility. And it was a college. There's both a language library and a resource center. And a few kilometers away from there is the schools that has nothing. In fact, there's quality books in the resource center. And what the committee couldn't understand is it's essentially the school this side and over the road, you are at the center and the education department right there in the district itself, not speaking to one another in terms of the district offices being used there and the school. That's as a side. I think I suspect there must be areas like that in this country, and it would be good if an instruction in the department goes out to assess that.
we actually found it shocking that it was in that situation. Secondly, I think the issue about screening, I had to do a short stunt in health, and it was very clear to me that it's quite ad hoc, it was a very short one, and it was in, and I could see there is not really, at a provincial level, structured engagement, regular engagement between health and education. And I think the point that has been raised about screening, it really can't be just on an ad hoc basis. It cannot be. It cannot be. And most probably it is a campaign. We know there's going to be limited resources, but most probably it is a campaign where private sector and everyone else can be brought on board. And one would really, I personally experienced a situation. It was in Eye Care Month, where we've tested children, and this one child was, I think, grade 4 or 5, and she couldn't see in front of her. And just putting up the specs, immediately she was able to actually see in front of her. And then you realize the injustice that has happened over the last couple of years. So if that was detected, it would have just changed life at school for that particular child. Fortunately, that particular one was able still to grow in education, but how many others didn't? So it is something really that I suspect most probably to the Basic Education Committee that needs to really be investigated and reported back on. Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. Way back we used to have exit exams for grade 6 and 9, which exam actually served to keep our learners on toes and even, you know, to perform better and achieve these certificates and also prepare them for grade 12. But since the discontinuation of these exams, I think the decline of performance has been quite significant in our learners. The question is, would the department consider reintroducing this exam in order to actually keep our learners involved highly in their learning so that they want to achieve the standard 6 certificate, and thereafter now they are getting for grade 9 certificate so that they get used to writing exams and not only write exams at grade 12 and perform so badly. The other question that I have is, one of the goals of the branch of the FET is to increase the number of FET learners. Does this increase include learners who dropped out between grade 8 and 11 or only those who passed matric? And if so, what happens to learners who could not reach matric, who has actually failed matric? Would they be left to roam the streets? And the other one is, currently there are 500 Denali schools. Has the department achieved its intention with Denali schools? And is the number of Denali schools therefore going to increase beyond 500? Or it's going to just stop there? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. So mine was on the district development. I just want to check about that the draft policies on the roles and the responsibility of the district. Whether do you do some monitoring on it? And then secondly, I was touched about that one of harmonization of structures, jobs, description, responsibility for districts. Can I get a clarity on that, on both of it? Thank you, Chairperson.
Directed us to the next phase. So is there any issues under institutional development therefore? So then we start dealing with that. Shwana and Dr. James.
Chairperson, thank you.
And I feel bad if I have to come back and speak on the same thing. But sometimes we need to get assistance, and it needs to come from the Department of Education. DG, we are not talking of kids who fail in class. A child who has been going to school every day. Maybe one can say a child with dyslexia. It's very difficult to explain that kind of situation. But I know a person born in 1973 who cannot read and write. And this lady went to school every day of her life. She couldn't make it until they realized that she doesn't pass. We are saying for everybody to work in South Africa, we depend on the Department of Education to skill people. And we're not saying we undermine that people must not get matric. Yes, it's good for everybody to have matric. But then, because of that, you don't even start. You don't even have grade A-O-R. That's the first thing. And secondly, there is something that the lady said, because I don't want to come back and talk about this in the next phase, about these quintile one schools, that something that you want to do there. Now, there is a predicament out there that this quintile... You know that it's possible for two schools in the same village and with kids, brother and sister, like siblings, going to different schools. One is quintile one and the other one is somehow quintile three in the same village. It's a fact. And how do you make sure that these kids coming from the same family, one is advantaged because that one, that particular school is quintile one and the one just next door is not quintile one. Thank you.
Then look at institutional development, and you can respond to those issues in the responses, but it's three areas: district development, FET colleges, higher education institutions. Member Mashishi, in fact, started to raise that as a critical issue on institutional development.
I had a question, thank you very much, a question on FET colleges and higher education institutions. With regards to the FET colleges, we know that they have been identified as the new avenue of major growth. And there's broad agreement, certainly between the parties, that that's right. And in fact, figures like 3 million students ought to be drawn into it. Presently, the enrollment figures, I think it's about 120,000, plus the new cohort that's coming in. I'm having the first of a number of engagements with the minister tomorrow of higher education around some critical issues to do with the governance model for FET, because as we know, it's been funded and run by provinces up until now. The minister would like to see it run more centrally, but clearly there's advantages to having a model that allows for regional strength and national direction, and there needs to be clarity on this question. So I wanted to know what progress has been made in confirming what the governance model will be for the FET college sector, firstly. And secondly, you've completed the recapitalization program. If there's going to be increased, let's say, density of students in the existing infrastructure, what are the plans for that? And what are the plans for genuinely expanding this, especially under recessionary circumstances where the budget allocation for allowing for exponential growth, in fact, is very severely limited. So that was that question. On the higher education institutions, I raised the issue yesterday, and let me just raise it again today. A particular interest in seeing what the thinking is around the match between universities of technology in particular, and our economic growth pattern for the future in this world of globalization. And that's just really a question about where the department's thinking is in terms of how one links economic development, which is Minister Ibrahim Patel's portfolio, and its link with trade and industry, and its link with the National Planning Commission, and what higher education institutions do in terms of human resource development.
Anyone else? Member Gina?
the programs for level 3-4 programs for the FET colleges, when you read the report, seemingly after the introduction of this NCV, the results are a little bit poor. I'm just asking and taking as to say is it, whether the department has just looked at that, whether it can happen that since now we are even accepting learners of grade 9, are we not seeing these programs maybe a little bit pitch high for that level? Can this be the cause for that, or what can be the causes of that, so that I think as we move forward, we can be in the position to say how do we rectify that issue, we make sure that the products that you get, the easy products that you are getting. Thank you.
Just to try and understand on FET, I understand there's joint work between the department and law enforcement agencies on some agreement as to your annual. What is it specifically for? If I may understand, then I'll give you the follow-up later. Just to understand in terms of that, because I understand it's looking at the institution, but I'm not so sure why would you do a joint law enforcement for the FET.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Mr. Masuri to deal with some of the FET issues and hopefully respond to them all. But let me just clarify. I think what you're referring to, ma'am, is the Department of Safety and Security has asked us to use FET colleges to train safety and security officers. So I don't think it's not a law enforcement program. It's in fact a training in law enforcement that FET colleges are running. So perhaps that's what's been referred to. But I don't think there's anything special needed in our FET colleges that we're running with. Let me just deal with some of the other matters, though. Mr. Bonoma asked about exit exams at grade 6 and 9. I think we have reported to this committee, of course, that we now have national assessments, which are national examinations at grade 3, grade 6, and at grade 9 level. So, in fact, we are testing all children based on a national test at grade 3, at grade 6, and at grade 9 level. Now, I think the only difference, Mr. Bonoma, is that, of course, we do not refer to these in any way as exit examinations. We don't want to even encourage the notion that people should be thinking of leaving school, even at grade 9. So, really, these are seen as progress assessments. Are children progressing at the rate they're expected to? But we really want to send a message that children should be spending the full 12 years in school, but these certainly are serving to provide those benchmarks to see whether individuals are indeed meeting the outcome standards that have been set in that way. Now, on the district, let me just explain. As we said, there is purely a draft policy at this stage, so it is going to have to go through the consultative processes. So at that stage, at this stage, certainly we are not monitoring that policy. It has not yet been declared as policy, but let me say it has been drawn up based on some very extensive empirical research that was done around the state of districts across the country. And in fact, what has led us to the need for a draft policy was the extraordinary different approaches taken in all our different provinces. In some, it's justified. Gauteng, fairly small region, well-developed, easy to contact, they will have a particular model of governance because probably no one is more than 1 hour from head office. If they need something, they can just pop in and get it, etc. Limpopo, Eastern Cape is very different. The district is pretty well on its own. It's probably 6-8 hours maybe from head office. They have to do a lot of things that otherwise might be handled differently. So we accept that there will be a need perhaps for a differentiated model, but I don't think the kind of diversity that we've got at the moment is appropriate. Let me ask perhaps Mr. Masuri first, and then Dr. Kobela, you'll deal with the higher education question if we can. Mr. Masuri?
Thank you, DG. I would attempt to deal with some aspects.
Before you proceed on the question, I just wondered while DG is on the floor. Page 152 of the annual report speaks on students' complaints and achievement. It says that all meetings with stakeholders on with law enforcement agencies. That's the question I'm asking. Why would you involve law enforcement agencies in institutions if it relates to student complaints?
People seem to have some sense about that. Let's go and then
Thank you, Chair. The maybe in relation to the relationship between the FET sector and the law enforcement agencies in this particular sense, we should indicate, having introduced the national certificate vocational programs in FET colleges, what the FAPS approached the Department of Education to want to develop a program along the lines of the NCV for the training of members of the FAPS, and that is the only context that we know we have been able to deal with in that particular regard.
So I think, Chloe, we're all misreading it. I think Dr. Kubela has clarified. If you look at the heading of that page, it is dealing with our private FET colleges. And the complaints we get, of course, are from students, particularly around this time of year, they suddenly want to write exams and they suddenly find the institution is not registered. So the complaints then come from the students. So that particular reference is, in a sense, what do we say to these law enforcement agencies now? Do they go out and prosecute the manager of these colleges? It's that question that has been posed. So, Mr. Matua, I don't know what we've concluded on that, but that is the issue that has been raised. How do we enforce the compliance with the FET Act in regard to private college registration? Sorry about that, Chair.
Okay.
Digi, I think this is actually part of a process that we follow in terms of always as part of the registration of private FET colleges. There's a process that we put in place that seeks to ensure that the fly-by-nights are not, or learners or students are actually protected from the fly-by-nights. And this is a process that we put in place to then direct any complaints of any college that may not be on the register that would be offering these programs to society. We ensure that we present them and make them available to FAPS for further investigation and prosecution. Chair, in relation to the matter on the enrollment of FET colleges, it's actually not a 129,000 number that is being referred to. It's actually those learners that have only enrolled for the NCD programs. But remember, there's also, in the current context, there's also other programs other than the NCD programs that are being offered at the FET colleges, and the current enrollment rate at the level of FET colleges sitting at the level of about 400,000. Through our enrollment planning processes, we have wanted to expand, as a result of the recapitalization, expand the system to a million over a period of time, and that is the direction that is being used in this particular regard. There's a particular question that was asked in relation to the pass rate and the challenges that have been faced. What the department has done in this particular context, in collaboration with provinces and all of the FET colleges, we have sought to make sure that there were dedicated student support services that were provided. And in this particular case, the student support has actually focused on three fundamental areas. One, in terms of how colleges would go to do a recruitment of learners that would go into NCD programs and therefore offer guidance. But secondly was how we would then help to support prospective students into selecting appropriate programs and placement. Chair, our reports of the monitoring of the pass rate and the retention in FET colleges in 2008 began to show that when we compare the enrollment in NCD programs compared to the retention rate, we actually found that by October, we already had, there was a 95% retention in NCD programs. What became a challenge was the pass rate, and what different colleges have done was to introduce different intervention mechanisms, particularly in areas of mathematics. And many of the colleges have also gone to extent of introducing a program that they call Plato, which seeks to ensure that it helps to improve the learner skills in relation to mathematics, and it's an aspect. The pass rate issue is an aspect that we are continuing to monitor very closely.
Pass rate.
The FET
colleges.
It differs. The average you would have to take in terms of program for program.
No, that's what I'm saying. General average, not even going program to program.
You say it's over 50%, if I were to put it in that way. Yeah. So it becomes difficult to put it in a broad sense like that. Chair, there was a question asked in relation to the Dinalady schools whether they have actually met the target. I think we're noting that if we consider that we had set ourselves a target as a nation that we would get 50,000 learners passing mathematics at high levels and at a high level or higher grade level in 2008, and we know that as a country we were able to surpass that number by 13,000. So there has been the worst significant movement in terms of the number of learners that pass mathematics in the system, and I think in that context there was significant movement, and in a sense the interventions that were made in this particular area were beginning to point to the direction. In relation to the Dinaledi schools, what was the contribution of Dinaledi schools? One of the things that we need to note is that the Dinaledi schools actually make up, the 500 Dinaledi schools make up 7% of the total number of secondary schools that we have in the country. But their contribution to the actual total number of learners that passed mathematics at 50% and above in 2008 was 24%. So if you begin to look into that, so the contribution of the Dinaledi schools in the total number of learners that passed mathematics at 50% and above was highly significant in terms of the contribution that it made, and it is in that context that we would feel comfortable that there's evidence of good performance that is emanating from the Dinaledi schools in this particular regard. I think what we should be able to tell the honourable members in terms of how this has also been dealt with is the extent to which we have put in support processes for Dinaledi schools. On an annual basis, the Dinaledi schools are actually externally monitored by a team, and this is a team of your retired teachers, education research experts, and so on, that goes to determine early the kind of support that these schools may require, and therefore we ensure that we provide for Tanya's intervention. Chair, however, we should indicate that the Dinaledi schools resourcing has always been a challenge, because in a sense, many of the accomplishments that we have found in Dinaledi schools have been as a result of the kind of support that nationally has been provided. However, provincial allocations of Dinaledi schools have been inadequate or uneven, and it is in that context that we're wanting to continue to ensure that we provide that support.
Chair, thank you. Honourable Member James, the issue I think of the governance model for the colleges is a matter I presume you will take with the minister through the chair. But I think a principle that the department has been discussing is one which says that the governance model of any institutional form needs to be appropriate to the purpose of that form. And as we go forward and clarify many of these things, I'm sure that the final model will emerge within that particular context. It is not assumed that automatically that everything that happens at universities needs to then automatically flow into the college system. Mm-hmm. With regard, Chairperson, to you, again, the issue of the match between the way in which the university system, and in this instance particularly the universities of technology, in the economic trajectory of the country, one of the core steering instruments of the system that we instituted in the early 2000 period was to ensure that the system is planned and planned appropriately. Planned in a way that is responsive to national economic and social needs. And the primary instrument that we have been using is both setting enrollment and graduate output targets through an iteration between ourselves and institutions. The first cycle comes to an end in 2010, and we have already initiated the second cycle for the period 2011 and beyond. And part of what informs that is the National Human Resource Development Strategy, the Industrial Strategy, as well as the medium-term strategic framework of government to ensure that what it is that we want going forward informs the choices that we make today, simply because it takes time for us to be able to respond to those particular needs. And just to give the flavor, one of the things that we have done is to prioritize at least four key areas, given the direction that I think our economy is growing and I think the country is growing. These include the engineering sciences and the built environment. We are making significant investment in capital infrastructure, and that capital infrastructure includes the houses that we are building for our people, and not just the roads. But engineering also goes into industrial processes and industrial engineering to be able to support the manufacturing strategy of the country. The health sciences is the second key strategic area of importance, I think, of the country if you're going to sustain some of the social services that we need to provide. And so whether it's doctors, physiotherapists, dentists, dental technicians, and so forth, but that full area. The third, probably the most important in the context of this committee, is teachers. Teacher education is the third key area that we've identified. And the last, but certainly not least, and I don't want to assume that these are the only ones, is the natural and physical sciences. And included in here is the agricultural sciences. We still have a very, very important component of our economy is supported by the agricultural industry. And in particular, animal and plant health are critical, particularly if we intend to export some of the produce that we, whether it's plant or animal produce. We have noticed, I think, sometimes that barriers are no longer tariff barriers, but barriers come through in the form of all sorts of requirements of health and safety expectations. And so the agriculture industry is important. Also included in there is the information, communication, and technology. Because, again, if we are going to be a knowledge economy with ICT, computer science, and the related industries need to be supported strategically. And there are a whole range of other sciences that we could put in there, the environmental sciences. But they all fall under the basket of the natural and physical sciences. We need people who are doing mathematics, physics. We're investing quite heavily in astronomy with the South African Large Telescope as an example, and we need to obviously have those. And lastly, actuarial sciences and economists as well as accountants. So that informs the way in which we plan a system going forward. And in conclusion, I think it's something that members may not be aware through the chair, that our universities of technology, their enrollment by and large is 50%, if not more, science and technology already. But it's how we then shape that mix in a specific sense, but also improve the efficiency to ensure that the output is good within the context of good quality. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm so sorry I was not here in the last 2 weeks, and particularly yesterday, because I might just be trying to be clever, only to cover things that have already been covered. So I'm sorry about that. But let me just share how I feel about the report, if I may, rather than probably pinpointing one particular thing, even though I might along the way. One is that I read the report first of all is with regards to higher education and FET colleges. One can almost already feel the split between the two departments, because I think for me it's too thin on detail to the extent that we can engage it insofar as the annual report is concerned. I mean, we have had a lot of conversations with higher education And I'm sure we already understand what the thinking is, but to the extent that it should have been covered on this, at least on what I have here, I have no doubt that in the annual report, which I did not have time to read, it is covered. So I'm just saying that one can almost pick up immediately that there is less detail on higher education, probably for the reasons that I am mentioning. Two is that reading the report, I see that there are aspects of achievements versus challenges. It's a very difficult for me to have a sense of achievement if that achievement is not presented against what targets there were. So it just, you can tell me how many things you have done, but then it does not satisfy that performance-wise you have done the things that you set yourself to do. Unless, of course, if you go to reasons for under expenditure or expenditure report, then that becomes the reason for the targets. But for me, they don't happily coincide. There is nothing as dangerous as a country whose education is in transition, because learners go through that kind of system. And it is a bit unsettling, therefore, to see that the education itself is just going through, and rightfully so, it must of necessity to go through that. But I say this because if you have a five-year plan and you have to present an annual report, surely you must present an annual report against a five-year plan if it is a five-year plan, such that by the time you give us what we have done, then you tell us what is outstanding, which you did not do and should have done. So for me, it does not satisfy me that then we do not know what is outstanding going forward. And the reason for that is because we're also dealing with a political environment. A political environment that has got a turnover of ministers, naturally so. But we also have to protect a country against every minister coming and against every minister effective change every time. Because if you have targets for the country, then you have targets for the country. And it does not mean that a minister cannot come and rectify that which needs to be rectified. So for me, I need, myself, is that I would have wanted more of a broader report. Of course, I know the formula and how reports are done, but one would have then had a sense that this is where we were going, and this is where we fell short because of this, but this is where we were going. And that for me is a challenge. And of course, the whole issue of under expenditure, which I think we will talk about when we get to that point. But it is a little bit frustrating because for me, for what the department did not achieve, it explains it in why it under it underspent, and that's not that. And lastly, for me, the whole issue of challenges. Again, I wish that there would be challenges that speak to what I see they don't speak to in terms of the expenditure report. Because when you go to expenditure report, it doesn't cover what the challenges are. For me, I would have had much more calmness or a sense of if you had then said these are the challenges, and in order for us to address these challenges, these are the things then going forward in the next year we would have wanted to cover. Thanks.
Can I then conclude this part by saying that also on the issue of FET colleges, I think most probably it's better to be more explicit at times with and not too diplomatic. I think we all know there's serious issues there. If we talk just above 50%, I remember giving a document to our members in the higher education and training, where an analysis was made that in IT, in civils, built environment, in fact, it is as low as 20 to 25% at the better institutions. So we do know there is a serious crisis where we are sitting at FET colleges. Also, we do know that there is an anomaly when it comes to our focus on post-schooling and what we are able to give support to, in fact, at those institutions. So that's the reality. In relation to higher education, 44% on average failure rates, dropout rate, it's serious. It's quite serious if you just take the NSFAS analysis. So, but I think we are in that transition where judgment has been casted on education in our country. A analysis was made on that, and there is a positioning in terms of schooling and post-schooling. So somehow this is part of the legacy issues where through the, in fact, when you spoke about the approach now even of union leaders, it's in fact after that meeting with the president that not only with the unions but also with all the principals. So there is a very strong focus on management. There's a strong focus on getting leadership of everyone that's dealing with school, even the school governing bodies, to deal with the non-negotiables in the appropriate way. So I think we are in that transition, and we need to be able, in fact, some of the unintended consequences will have to be evaluated upfront around how, as we are splitting, and the implications for that split. So that's the space. The annual report comes in the context of the year when education, not only by the department, but also by government as a whole and all political parties, were evaluated. And what we are still obviously analyzing now, it's the past, and I think we are starting to put the trajectory for the future. I think that's where we are currently. If the DG wants to respond, finally, and then we really need to move ahead to... Member Gobai, you also raised, I think in the context that the member just raised, you raised the question yesterday in the committee meeting on just a generic analysis on performance. And I think we'll get to that point because she started to introduce it. So that it's not on the items that was presented necessarily in the slides, but it is to analyze properly in terms of the quality issues, the performance stuff, etc. So that point also we introduced yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. And I think we'd want to endorse both your sentiments. This is a report from a particular period, and we need to understand in that context. And certainly we take your advice if the areas that you think are thin. You know, perhaps understanding, of course, with the universities in particular, that they are autonomous institutions. So to a large extent, we're not reporting on the detailed work that they do, but in a sense, our relations with them. But I think we take the advice, certainly. Chair, I'm more concerned about the comments about the nature of the report, although the Honourable Member was honest enough to say she hadn't had time to read the full report. But certainly, Chair, you know, in our report, which, by the way, includes both a five-year plan and a one-year plan, so there is a one-year operational plan. That is the plan that we report against. That plan has very clear performance indicators that talk about numbers and targets and those sort of things. And in this report, certainly, we indicate whether we've achieved those or not. And then there is a column that says comments, which I think should be taken as, you know, these are the challenges, these are the things we need to do about them, etc. So I would hope that it is there, Chair. Probably I can mention at this stage, because and I can do it because I'm not necessarily involved in the final writing up of it. I did receive the other day a rather nice parcel from the South African Institute of Government Auditors, in which they presented us an award for the best annual report of a national department. So whether they're right or wrong, I don't know. I'm just recording that fact, Chair, but it did achieve that this year. Thank you very much.
Well then, shall we then move? We've taken note of the sentiments and the reasons why there's an under-presentation on higher education. Obviously, we believe we actually need to get into that detail, but as I said, it's under bridge in a sense. Shall we continue then to we finalized the priorities. I've looked at the subsequent slides around the programs. You would see that a lot of the issues were actually dealt with, even in the questions that you've posed yesterday, under the first two priorities and subsequently today under the three priorities. Those are the issues that's been flagged. If you are comfortable with that, then we, in fact, can go over to the financials, unless we want to deal with some of those generic questions quickly, I would be comfortable with, and then we can go over, so that we don't need to go slide by slide on the details now of the program. So I'm noting two hands here, Member Kubai and Michelle.
Chair, I propose that we deal with generic, because even on programs, you did not deal with the administrative part because your program has administration and other issues. So we dealt with the priorities, but there are issues that are still pending out of the other areas. So I propose that let's deal with them generically and then move immediately to the panel.
I hope members understand what I'm suggesting, that we therefore don't go slide by slide, but that we actually deal with. So if somebody raised the issue on a program or on administration, etc., then we capture all those questions and input, and then we get the responses. Because most of the issues that Anna picked it up, if we're going to follow it now, the way there, you are going to re-ask some of the questions. We're going back to Garigudia, we're going back to adult education, etc., etc. So, Member Mushwana, you want to kick off?
Yeah, thanks. And Chairperson, that will be very good, because you see, I forgot my specs, and I don't know where you are. I come with issues that are serious within education, and some of them are not responded to because maybe you are like a little bit out of order. Such that I think if we come with issues that will help this country, if it's written somewhere, we need to get a response. Thank you.
You is there any issue that you want to ask? I'll say it's written down here. So. Okay.
Cool.
Member Kubai and then Member Gina. Yeah, we get there now. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. It's unfortunate, honorable member. Muslim. You know, I don't know how he managed to walk until here. Okay. Chair, there are generic issues that I just want us to deal with around administration. DJ, I think I need to commend you for making sure that the staff has signed the performance agreement. I know it's a challenge within the national departments that you get to have almost everybody sign their performance agreement. But around performance, I know that one of the things that we need to start trying to do as government is to start auditing performance. Because auditing only finances, and we still have a lot of issues around service delivery and all that. It's still not getting us where we want to get as a country, and therefore I'm one of those of the view that we need to start audit performance. And therefore just wanted to check in terms of the performance of your staff, DG. Do you have any member of senior management? I've looked at the report. It reflects some of the members not being eligible for bonuses. And for me, it would say that the other cities have done what they were expected to do or less. But the issue is that you have members who did not perform according to their contracts, what they have signed, underperformed meaning, and what are steps that have been taken to try and correct those things. Because for me, that's where it starts. For us to achieve service delivery, it has to start with individuals within the organization. And it goes to the point of making sure that all of us who are in the department, meaning yourself, DG, all of you who are in the department actually achieve what you have set to achieve. The priorities of the minister can be seen if the performance of members are not really there. Another area that I wanted to speak on besides the performance, which is more linked, some of the programs I've looked at, the international agreements, international activity, I know you have a section that deals with that. What value are we getting out of those agreements? Value for money for us. It's nice to have SA Nigeria bilateral. We encourage the relations with SADC. We encourage the MOUs that we sign. But to what extent, and I'm talking in relation to the amount spent that we do spend and the program itself. The last one, Chair, I'm just trying to find my notes. No, I think let me just pause the budget generally.
Can I just add, DJ, on the issue of performance agreements, the appraisal, and in fact, because my understanding is they need to be quarterly, if I'm right, actual assessment. But I'm not picking that up unless I looked at it. And I didn't really pick it up because I know the compliance has been met. That's really the issue. So we've complied with the performance agreement between the minister and yourself and the subsequent people.
However, the turnaround in terms of that quarterly or agreement or appraisals, just in addition to what she said. Anyone else on the, sorry, Member Gina?
I'm asking again on one of the achievements that our department has achieved. In the era of AVET, I believe that the N2F level 4 is equivalent to metric, if I'm correct in putting that. I just want to know, yeah, we do have learners getting that N2LF level 4. I'm checking on the articulation on that. Do we have that link with the higher institutions that say a learner with AVET NQS level 4 can go straight directly from that to the university? Because I don't want, I'm afraid that maybe we might be proud to say we are producing these learners, but really we don't see what is it that they do after that. Can they articulate as easy as that from that and go straight to the higher education institution, universities, and whatever? If not so, what is it that you are doing so that you can see that this impact is helping in our country, those learners can go from? Thank you.
Anyone else? Member Michael Bill.
Thanks, Chair. Just to get a general understanding on how the institutions that are linked to the department account to the department. I know there are many councils on higher education, there's FAQA, there's Umalusi, there's NSFAS, all of them. Do they report or account to their councils or boards and so on? Or there's a way in which they interact with the department itself. The reason why I'm raising this is that you meet these institutions because we interact with them as a portfolio committee. They give you a particular version. And it's not always the case that when you meet the department, you get clarity that it's actually also as obtaining within those institutions. So it's easy to, for instance, talk about the private institutions that are not registered and so on, or somewhat unscrupulous. But then either SAQA or any other may say, no, we are not enforcing that, and you don't get a sense who's enforcing it or who's doing what. So I'm just trying to say to the DG that to me, you don't need a situation where an employee, for instance, sit in a board or a council by virtue of that person being employed by the department and take that as a sense of accountability. There must be a formal interaction between these institutions and the department, so that even within your annual reports, in as much as they will do their own annual reports, but there should be some reconciliation or harmony in between what we get from these other institutions and the department itself.
Thanks, Chair. The clarity that I want to get is that how do you find it effective? Do you find it effective with the paper examination that you publish on newspapers to assist learners? Have you found any response in terms of that? And if you find response, you know, what improvement has it given you? The other aspect is that how do you also ensure the monitoring of the systems of examination distribution to schools? As we have noticed that in recent years we've discovered that there's these tendencies of examinations being leaked, well, and it's very, very disturbing. I'm raising this with a concern that it's always coming from my province.
So I know that the members are only saying the reason. But it really raised a very serious concern with me. And I think thanks, Member Ponswa.
Thank you. I'm short. I haven't exceeded my quota this time around. Chair, under norms, national norms and standards for school infrastructure, I would like to know whether the department, or how far rather, department has implemented the presidential injunction, not this president, the previous one, which said wherever there is a school, there must be a road, electricity. This was the presidential injunction, if I remember correctly, which would then be encompassed by the national norms and standards. Is that the case?
Other question before we go to the finances, Mr. Smart.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to additional funding to reduce the learner-educator ratio, can the department please give more information on that one? And what is the sort of impact of that additional funding? Then, on the legislation with regard to NIDU, what is the position right now? What progress is there? Yeah, I will stop there. Thank you, Chair.
I'm sorry. I just found my note. I wanted to check, TG, staff turnover in terms of your vacancy, your staff turnover in terms of resignation and vacancy rate. Secondly, it's the issue of do you have any member of your SMS seven who had faced disciplinary for the previous financial year, the one that you accounted for?
Can we get responses?
Yes. Chair, let me, I'll allow the CFO just to reflect on that, the CFO to reflect on the staff turnover. Let me just say, though, that the one thing a recession does is make government jobs a lot more attractive. And I think there are people who might otherwise have been looking to move out suddenly saying, hold on, let me stay here. So that's a good thing, but the actual figures we'll get. No, there were no SMS members under disciplinary action in the year under review. And Chair, that probably then brings me to the other point. Thank you. The performance agreements indeed were all signed as required. We also, of course, had 100% compliance on the declaration of interest forms, so hopefully those areas are there. Look, we fully agree that this isn't just about financial audits, it's about performance audits as well, and of course the Auditor General now does conduct performance audits and not just a financial audit, and that it will be part of the financial statements that we'll refer to there. We do have in the department a very rigorous performance management and development system that is carried out every year, in particular at the end of the year, to get a sense of that performance. And you're right, there are a number of officials who then don't qualify for either a notch or a bonus. And in that case, we are obliged, and we do work with the individual and look at possible training options to try and, in the first instance, bring that person up to the required standard rather than forcing them out. So we do have that. I think we would acknowledge that the quarterly reviews that are supposed to take place are probably not as well done as they should, and in fact that was a comment of the Auditor General that those quarterly reports were not coming in particular on time, and that's something that we have worked on this year to try and ensure that it does happen. But overall I think we are blessed with a relatively good management layer in the Department of Education, and broadly we've been able to see good performance by almost all of them. On the international relations, you ask about the value we get from that. And I think, you know, before answering it, we need to say that, yes, part of it is, of course, what this country gets out of it. But I think we've also got to accept a responsibility, particularly in relation to our position on the continent, that also says, what do we give in terms of international relations? It can't just be about getting. And perhaps one of the biggest external obligations we get, and that isn't often talked about, is the number of foreign students that we have studying in this country, paying local rates, as it were, and that effectively is costing this country an enormous amount of money. It's effectively donor aid that we're giving, but instead of giving it out to another country, we're saying we will give it by, in fact, accommodating your students here at university level, and they benefit from the reduced price. And, in fact, of course, other countries on the African continent are now asking for the same kind of deal that we give to our SADC neighbors that we look at there. But as I say, it's an important part there that we do. We do a lot of technical support to countries as well, for the DRC in particular. We are training a number of their people in terms of their needs and then setting up an education system. So part of it is about those obligations that we have, I think, to assist other countries. But let me say also that in terms of our own gains, we do get significant technical support from various countries in different areas. But perhaps the most significant one we had mentioned is a recent allocation by the EU of 120 million euros, so 1.2 billion rand, being given to us for the next 3 years for our foundations for learning exercise. So a real emphasis there on basic education, and obviously one of the gains we've had from a long-standing relationship with the European Union that will help us enormously, particularly in this time now when some of those monies are not going to be as available from our own internal fiscus as they would have been. The Honourable Member asked about NQF Level 4, and I'm just a bit careful that there's not confusion here. We have what we call an ABET Level 4. So ABET is divided into four levels. ABET Level 1 is simply functional literacy, just being able to write your own name and read documents, that kind of thing. And then you move through ABET Level 2, ABET Level 3, ABET Level 4. When you complete ABET Level 4, in fact, you're only at NQF Level 1. So equivalent, in fact, to a grade 9 qualification. So once you've done all your ABET programs, 4 years basically, that puts you on the equivalent of a grade 9 at school. You would then have to do NQF levels 2, 3, and 4 to get your matric level. So no, ABET level 4 is not equivalent to matric. NQF level 4 is matric level. And I know that does cause confusion in the system and probably something we should sort out. I think we're going to get rid of those ABET levels. They're not really helping us. Yeah. Provided you meet the other requirements of subject packages and levels of achievement in those subjects, certainly there's no difference between someone who's followed that route and someone who has been through a school route in terms of their admission to universities. In fact, they might even be beneficial because, of course, universities also apply the mature age exemption. So if you've got that NQF level 4 with the requisite exemption requirements, then certainly you would be admitted into higher education. Yeah, to what extent it's a common route, it might be something that we quiz. In obviously setting up the NQF, the whole point was about articulation and movement between different forms of study, etc. To what extent adult learners are going beyond their NQF level 1 and getting the 2, 3, 4 and moving to university, perhaps that's a different exercise. But legally, certainly, there's nothing that prevents them in that way that we would note. Yes, that's right, okay, and starting to engage with your CHE and institutions might be interesting, all right. On the question of the statutory bodies, we've got five statutory bodies which reported to the old Department of Education. Clearly they will now be split in these different ways. Look, each of them do have governing boards, councils, whatever they might be termed, but all of them come under the remit of the Public Finance Management Act. So none of them escape that in any way, and that sets very firm requirements. And in terms of those, they are required to report to us on a quarterly basis, which they all do, and we have checked that that does happen, and then, of course, have to table to us an annual report. We scrutinize those reports very carefully. You would see that in every case on a quarterly basis, when those reports come in, we interpret them, we analyze them, and we then provide a report to the minister to say that over this quarter, this statutory body has done the following, projections around expenditure, ABC, and we give that information. So we do watch them very closely. It's an interesting relationship because, of course, they're not under our formal ambit in the sense that we don't control them. They do have these governing boards, but certainly for us they are not a hands-off situation. We engage very closely with the work that they're doing, and we tend to sit on most of them as well to make sure that's happening. The universities are a bit different. They only provide us with an annual report. They're not obliged to provide those quarterly reports. But there are all sorts of requirements in terms of what they have to report on, research and others that have to be provided. So they are different, but they do report to us, yeah. The Mr. Masuri perhaps will comment on the study mate and that side of things. Let me just say on the exam distribution, obviously these are national exams now which are set and written across the country. The fact is, of course, it's a high-risk exercise because if one province, for example, in Mpumalanga leaks the paper, it has national implications. Schools in the Western Cape, et cetera, are then impacted on it. And in this case, of course, we did have it. I should point out, by the way, that this leak occurred within a private school, not a public school, but they are part of our exam system, so we take that responsibility. But just to understand the implications, it was the maths paper, the science paper, and one other that was seen to have been leaked. We always have contingency measures. We have a second paper ready to run, but of course we don't print it, hoping we're not going to need to. The fact now that it's been leaked, we've got to go to the second paper. You get 200,000 people writing the maths paper. There are two maths papers, so we have to print 400,000 new papers. That comes with, and each of those papers is about 15 pages, so they're quite substantial exam papers. Just think of the additional expense. We're talking probably 100 million rand just to reprint those papers, get them out in time for these new exams. The cost of that little leak of one teacher at a particular school actually sets the country back some 100 million rand to reprint all those papers and get them distributed. It's a huge problem, and maybe society more broadly has to take a very strong issue on this one. Mr. Patel, I don't know if your memory is better about the presidential injunction about every school having roads and electricity, etc. I knew about the one about under trees, and I think we've dealt with that one, but Mr. Patel might then comment. Perhaps if I can give to Mr. Masuri first in relation to the effectiveness of the study, mate.
I think that one was in the IFP manifesto. Yeah. That's the one that you referred to.
No, that's serious. There was that presidential injunction that wherever a school is built, there must be a road, there must be electricity, there must be water. My question is, under your norms and standards, does that include that presidential injunction?
On that one and then the other subsequent one.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I think the reason for the confusion is that where it is funded and it is policy, then clearly it needs to be done and it needs to be accounted for. My recollection is that the President was indicating that in terms of our planning, how we had to ensure that we have holistic planning. It's no use, you know, putting up a school and then not having a library, etc. Now, those also have, holistic planning requires holistic funding. So in terms of the national norms and standards for school funding, for national norms and standards for physical environment, that has gone out for public comment. It has also been, the public comments have been taken into account, it's been submitted to the Minister of Finance for concurrence. Being a provincial matter, national cannot set hard norms, however, it can set minimum norms, and provinces will have to phase those norms in over a period of time. So we're keenly awaiting the concurrence of the Minister of Finance in terms of those of the implementation of those norms. The Council of Education Ministers have also been given an implementation plan in terms of how they should phase the norms in terms of phases. In other words, wherever they are building new facilities, they have to ensure that they have to adhere to the minimum norms and standards, which is a total school environment, including library, etc. However, that at the same time, they must also begin to budget for maintenance of existing facilities. All those are, in a sense, soft targets because money is not allocated to it. And so all we could do from a national level is to provide a basis in which they particularly face those norms in. We would like, and we are working very rigorously with National Treasury, to ensure that we find other means and mechanisms of financing that we will be able to bring and supplement the national revenue in order to deal more decisively with those backlogs over a short period of time. Thank you, Chair. Yes. In terms of the learner-educator ratio, in the 2009 medium-term budget policy statement, we did make a bid that last year the funds were then allocated starting 1st of April 2010. We have 1.8 billion then allocated that will see a 3% increase in the number of teachers being employed and a reduction of learner-educator ratio. 3% is about 10,000 new posts that would come online by 2011. Chair, I didn't catch the question on need you. Okay. The National Education Evaluation and Development Unit, there was a ministerial committee report. The report was published and it also went out for public comment. Public comment has been taken, has been received, and at the moment the matter is with the Minister of Basic Education receiving attention. However, funds have also been allocated for this financial year for the establishment of an interim unit. A chief executive officer, Mr. Ronnie Schwartz, has been appointed a month ago to be able to look at the form and the structure of the NIDU unit. But however, and is also busy preparing the, assisting the minister in terms of a position. As soon as the position, draft position is out, that position itself will be tabled out for public comment, and that can then lead towards either, most probably leads to legislation around the evaluation unit. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Vijay. The question in relation to the effectiveness of study made and other supplements that the department developed and distributes, so I think it's, we would want to deal with it in the context in which they have been developed. I think the context in which these have been developed emanates from the fact that one of the fundamental things that is noted we should provide is the availability of text and other forms, textbooks and other forms of text as a means of expanding the learning and teaching environment, and it is in that context. I should indicate that one of the things that these study mates have also carried and supplements have carried are your study tips from experts that then become a useful resource for learners to use and teachers alike. And similarly, what they have also begun, what they have also contained were exemplar papers that begin to give teachers an indication of the kinds of quality assessment tasks that they could have. And it is on that basis, Chair, that we have found that there has been a demand created by schools to actually make this available. Maybe for honorable members to note as well, flowing from this is an intervention that was started from the when we had the recovery plan. And post that, South Africa, in fact, the Department of Basic Department of Education was, in fact, awarded by the International Association of the Press an award for having initiated the process of study making and giving that. And I think that that's an indication of the extent to which the contribution that the supplements are making contribute to the level of improving quality in education. And therefore, the question is the effectiveness. There has been a demand by schools, there has been a demand from learners, and it is in that context that we're providing a support.
Two people,
one general. We'd like to go back to the leakage of five question papers. Mr. Hindle, you already mentioned 100 million rand, the amount of 100 million rand. I think the portfolio committee is entitled to get the whole story, the story behind the story. What exactly happened? You mentioned a teacher. Did it leak at the district? How did the teacher get access to the paper? And then, secondly, you mentioned that the department used a second paper. What will happen when a second paper gets leaked? Are there any solutions to a possible problem in this regard? And what about the possibility of a question bank to solve problems in future?
No, well, my question was relating to what are the plans of preventing this thing to happen again? And that's what I wanted to get.
Those the problems with that. Reconfigure that particular problem. I think that's what you're saying. Alternatively, pull the 100 million from there.
Charge them maybe for that. Let me be cautious about the costs. I think I would want to come back and indicate an actual cost. These are just estimates, but I think it's important that people know the seriousness of the implications of these kind of things. But we will be able to come back to you with, I think, the actual figures that this has, in fact, incurred for the country as a whole. And bearing in mind, of course, that a lot of the printing is done at a provincial level, this, in fact, affects your poorest provinces, KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, and Limpopo, with the most number of students, in fact, bear the highest cost of this because they then have to take responsibility for running off those additional papers. So really, it's just something that we can't afford in the system, and I think we'd all agree on that. I can't give you the full story now. The matter is being investigated. We have a National Exam Irregularities Committee. They have got reports, certainly, from the school and the province. They will be compiling a full report which will be taken to the minister, and on that basis obviously steps will be taken, but you would be aware that the SAPS have already in fact initiated things here and had even made arrests at an early stage, so that matter is being investigated. I hesitate to say there is no paper 3, so we will have to just hope like anything that obviously this doesn't happen, but certainly there's been no evidence of anything like that happening, and I would trust it's not the case. You know, ask how the teacher got hold of this. Well, of course, the papers are distributed to schools prior to the exam being written. They have to be. So they do come into the hands of schools, and clearly it was in some way presumably irresponsibly handled at the school level where that teacher was able to get the copy of it and that sort of thing. So these things happen. In terms of plans, certainly to deal with this specific one, we have deployed a team from National to Mpumalanga who will be continuing to sit there during the course of these examinations just to monitor processes, to try and ensure that what caused this doesn't happen again. But overall, I think you would have recognized the extraordinary efforts provinces overall have put into the security of examination systems. Some of them, like Gauteng, have been variously described as Fort Knox, etc. They really do invest very heavily in this one. And I think from a situation we had a number of years ago where this really was a rather common pattern and habit, certainly I think the fact that now we are picking up one case across the country is an indication that many of our plans around security have been effective in this regard. I think, Chair, that's all I can comment on, and if Mr. Missouri wants to add anything. But as I say, on the figure itself, Chair, I would be worried if people went out here now and started citing this 100 million. Let me be clear that we will give the exact figures of the cost of this, and we'll report it to the committee at that stage.
What we can do is to say which province. I think that's public news. On that note, indicate we also want to thank the department because if it is one paper amongst all those papers that's being written.
Sorry, before you think that, thank you.
You wanted to go back on?
No, I'm not going back. It's not back, it's not for us. Thank you. I know for a fact. No, this is very serious. I can't see, but I know there are things that I know for a fact that questions papers are not distributed to schools a day before. I know. The circuits are responsible. You are responsible until the morning when they write. So maybe the investigations must also go to the department at the circuit level.
That's definitely standing on that point. But it shows that we've seen less disruption.
currently as people are writing. So well done for that. Let's move to the financial. We are saying that around the compliance on performance agreements, those things are met, but there is an issue of the actual regular assessments and the link between those things. I think that point, you've acknowledged that, so we are taking that up. On the financials, members, the department has received an unqualified report. There are issues around information, performance analyses, and I think it relates to quality issues then subsequent to that, if you start delving deeper. But generally, the department has complied, and I think we need to acknowledge and thank you for doing that. As I've indicated earlier, in a breaking up and creating of how many, 2-3 new departments related to when you take the skills and higher education and you take the distinction between basic and higher, it is going to be a challenging one, especially in the context of vacancies that have occurred at labor department and that structure moving over the side, etc. So the space has to be watched closely. But over to you, Director General, and I think we've looked at the slide already yesterday. At least we're able to look at it overnight, but I'll give you to essentially give us the essence on this one.
Chair, thank you, and with those comments, I don't think it needs much. The first slide is just the breakdown of allocation versus expenditure, divided into our different categories of transfers to higher education institutions and other public entities, conditional grants, and then the compensation of employees, departmental operations and earmarked funds, Chair, the percentage spending against each of those is indicated, and of course the 99.8% spending rate that we achieved by the end of the year, thanks indeed to the work of our acting CFO and other officials. There is a saving of some 40 million, a deviation there, and I'll explain that in a moment, but the overall figure is certainly very high expenditure. The second slide then just breaks it down differently into the different programs, administration, et cetera, and you can see how the different branches were performing there, and in most cases also well up into the 90s, one issue around general education, which I'll explain in a moment. Chair, the next two slides just explain the reasons for under expenditure, but I think in the current climate we should also understand under expenditure has been savings, and in some cases these have been very deliberately engineered in order to provide money for priority areas. The real two big amounts that I think we would draw attention to, Chair, is on Program 3, the general education, that's the 25 million that was not spent. And, Chair, the major part of that was, in fact, the withholding of a transfer payment to Limpopo in respect of the HIV and AIDS conditional grant. The conditions of the grant require that provinces provide us a quarterly report in terms of the work they've done on the grant and also the exact spending on it. And, Chair, rightly or wrongly, if that report is not received or is not adequate in any respect, we are obliged to withhold the next tranche of that grant until those things are corrected. In this case, that was the case. Limpopo did not deliver on time and did not therefore meet the conditions of the grant. We were obliged to withhold that last quarter tranche. However, I am pleased to say, Chair, that that has now been rectified. Treasury has approved the rollover of that money, and therefore Limpopo is not held back in any way from implementing the program. And in the final quarter, they did still deliver on that conditional grant, and the money has been paid to them now in the new financial year to recompense them for that work. So that was the major part of that 25 million that was saved there. The other area, Chair, was in the higher education, the 7 million that constituted the rest. That was really just a financial matter with a case of interest and redemption being claimed, less than projected, so that effectively became a saving. All the rest, Chair, were really just technical items. Either UC Program 2, a service provider, couldn't be appointed in a particular case. There were some savings on the appointment of external moderators and savings on litigation, I'm pleased to say. Further education was deliberately saving money, partly because of the high cost of exams. School enrichment was also asked to contribute towards that, so they had some cost-saving measures. And then perhaps last one on Program 7, we pay to UNESCO an annual fee that is calculated in dollars. So when the exchange rate goes up when we pay it in good time, we get a discount basically, and that was the 0.6 million. So that 40 million, I think, Chair, effectively, as I say, a large part of it has been rolled over into that conditional grant. The other areas, in fact, have been areas of savings that we've been able to take money into other priority areas. So, Chair, the conclusion, as you say, from the Auditor General was an unqualified audit opinion, and we really appreciate that from the Auditor General. But as you have indicated, he did comment on two aspects. One was the inadequate quarterly reporting, and by inadequate there, what he is meaning is it wasn't produced in time. There are deadlines for these quarterly reports, and some of them from two branches were in fact received late. We've acknowledged that, and he has indicated that as a matter in his report, but we have set in motion processes now to ensure that happens in this financial year. Then he asked about whether the performance information was useful and reliable. I think that's an ongoing task that we have to continue to work on and ensure that it does meet all the standards of usefulness and reliability, and I think you would be a large part of the grouping who would advise us on whether these are in fact the case or not, Chair. So with that, unless I can see if I was in chat, that I think just covers the overall sense of the financial situation. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Member Chowan.
Just on the, well, firstly, let me just say that it's particularly gratifying to sit here annually with a department that has consistently delivered an unqualified audit, and I do think that congratulations. As much as when things go wrong, we come down hard on the department. Likewise, when there's a job good well done, then that we say so. And really, it speaks volumes about your own leadership, DG, and certainly the state of the financial department and officials working under you. So do convey that to them. Might I just say that on the emphasis on matter that the Auditor General reflects in the report, particularly around the inadequate quarterly reporting on performance information. Mr. Trudeau was there yesterday when we posed this question to the team that came to brief us, and I specifically asked whether in fact there was the matter related to late reports as opposed to no reports at all, and the response was they could not find the report. So I'm not quite sure if I see they're shaking of heads, but if that is the case, then perhaps that needs to be clarified with the actual audit team who briefed us as well.
Member Rosales.
DJ, this was raised even yesterday. I'm just repeating, since we're now dealing with finances and to understand exactly what we will do. We had a meeting wherein we interacted with the Chancellor on Higher Education. Dr. Tovela was there. The matter that came was that there's quite an amount, considerable amount of money that was received late by institutions of higher learning, in fact, the NSFAS money, which missed the target group, because the students who were supposed to have benefited had gone out of the system. So it was the end of the year. By yesterday, you didn't have much knowledge about it, but I'm saying that it's confirmed that that's money is sitting and the students did not get that money. All perhaps one needed to say was perhaps the department should give leadership in that regard to say what should happen to the money so that institutions of higher learning are not given the latitude to just redirect that money to any other thing rather than it being money that should benefit students. Whether they've gone to relieve them of their burden, obviously it means they are owing, or to ensure that it goes to another generation of students who have just come in. But I'm saying you will need to think hard about it and ensuring that there's clear directive to the institutions of higher learning. Thanks.
Any other final point? I'm noting the last two. In the Jordan and on page 145 to 146 of the annual report, it says training workshops were suspended until next financial year. No progress was made due to budgetary constraints. Now, the question is, did the department exhaust all its 2008 budget to the extent that it could not continue with this training workshops? Thank you, sir. Point?
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted, it's relating to the Auditor General's comments. There were specific areas that the Auditor General has raised. The first one is around social and school enrichment program. The second one around higher education and sub program. Just wanted to understand, DG, if there are measures put in place to respond to those, and if those would be adequate for that when you report for this current financial year, we don't have the same problem. Thanks. But again, the issue of the quarterly reports, which is in page 247, that they couldn't obtain evidence that the department prepared and submitted its second quarterly progress report for 08-09. What was the cause of that evidence not being available, and what was done to deal with it? Thanks, Chair.
The last question.
This is a more of a general comment than a question through you. One of the things that I've always found useful, and maybe it's not such a big factor in education, given that education does have a fairly substantial budget, but oftentimes when the department comes to account to the portfolio committee, particularly during the year and so on, and there are matters of priority and activities that have really just not been funded as unfunded mandates. We did have a practice in the previous portfolio committees that I chaired, where we would require the department to submit to us a list of all of the unfunded mandates, so that we have a good sense of what it is that you're not able to achieve. And we're unlikely then to put pressure on you to achieve on those targets as well, because I do think it's sometimes very unfair for us to present as we do our priorities, and there's clearly a dis-synergy between allocations of budgets and so on. But it'd be a good idea, I think, in future to do that, so that we're all speaking off the same page.
Just on that last one, to say that on Friday last week we were before the Select Committee on Appropriations, where we did indicate the areas we put in bids for and whether they've been successful or not. So I think at least to share with you, perhaps that presentation will give you a sense of some of the areas we hoped we could go to, but we're not able to. But we will continue to, I think, monitor on that one, Chair. Let me allow the Acting CFO, if I may, to deal with some of the financial aspects, and perhaps the higher education one, Dr. Kubela.
Thanks, Gigi. I think the most important one is the issue around the quarterly performance report, which the IG indicated that it's not received that specific report. It refers to the second quarterly report for 2008-09, which was in fact submitted. The IG did receive a copy of that. I did not want to brief him yesterday in the meeting around that issue. There was, however, two branches in the department who did not timely submit their inputs for that specific report. That was brought to the attention of the minister, and the minister did take steps against those two branches, and he did not reappear in the third and the fourth reports. So the matter was corrected during the financial year, but the Auditor General did feel that they need to report that, which one can understand. DJ, I don't think there's any other specific issue. I think the other matters are related to Dr. Q specifically, and that's all.
Thank you, DG, and through the chair and honourable members. It's often pleasing, Chairperson, when the Minister of Finance makes an adjustment to the medium-term expenditure framework around about November, and it's nice and it's extremely welcome. And I think we run into a bit of a conundrum during the year, and where we had an adjustment upwards, which went to the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, because that adjustment happens in the current financial year, but it happens in terms of our budgetary process and our cycle, round about November or so. However, university's financial year starts in January. And so it is very difficult for university now to allocate that additional money when you are looking at a student who was registered in January and who is coming to an end in terms of their studies in December at the time when the money arrives. So it's a dilemma of synchronizing government's financial years and university financial years. So as I think members would recall, Chairperson, NSFUS then has taken that money through into the next financial year to try and utilize it from the period in 2009, which would be in this calendar year rather than in the previous year. And I think that's where the dilemma arose. With regard to the report of performance information on page 248 of the annual report, where it stated that a measure of program 6 and sub-program strengthening planning to support the production of quality graduates is not time-bound. And I think part of what we need to continuously do is have an iteration with the AG's office in terms of having a common understanding that some of the work that we do in an education system cannot be time-bound. The improvement, we could probably say, in the period, hypothetically, from 2005 to 2010, as the Honourable Member was saying, what was our objective? What were our targets? And therefore, how are we making that improvement? That we can talk to, and as I said earlier, we then set new targets for, say, 2011 and beyond. But the purpose of continuously improving cannot be something that starts and ends within a particular timeline. So I think we would need to find ways, and I'm confident that we will find ways of making sure that the way in which we report is useful both to the AG and I think to the members of the Portfolio Committee in Parliament in particular, as well as obviously ensuring that we are able to monitor improved performance of the system as we go forward. So we are confident that the measures that we are going to put into place, or should I say have put into place for the current financial year to be reported for the 2009-10 financial year would be an improvement in this regard.
A final comment, Mr. Benoit asked about stopping certain programs. Regrettably, one of the responsibilities as accounting officer is to try and balance the books, and sometimes that requires hard decisions. In this particular year, remember, this was the first national exam that we had set. We faced significant additional and unanticipated expenditures around that exam, and therefore we had to draw money from other areas, and one of the options we had was to delay the training that was planned, and that was a decision we had to take, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it just a question? How many years did the department actually now receive an unqualified audit?
Certainly for the 5 years I've been there, but we did get one or two before that. I think the last time, in fact, we appeared before SCOPA was an extraordinary situation where my DG was being asked about loans which had been made to higher education institutions, I think back in the 70s, and which seemingly had not been repaid, and the DG was being asked to account for them. But certainly for the last 5 years I've been in office, we have received an unqualified audit. Thanks, Chair.
The reason I'm asking is I think we've already acknowledged and indicated appreciation. But I think if one then look back over the last, say, 5 to 7 years, and you actually then look at just the financials and the compliance, then it looks as all is well. But the reality in terms of our outcomes when it comes to education, all is not well. And I think that, for me, is the dilemma, which I think the issue... Yesterday, remember I raised the issue of the type of levels of auditing. Afterwards, the Auditor General came to the Auditor General's office came to me and then indicated they don't have it in levels, but they've got it in a sense the systems that they're using. And we then understood each other because it really relates to the performance auditing side of things. And I think that's really the dilemma, because you actually can comply, but it doesn't necessarily mean that performance and outcomes is happening in the way. And I think that's the next transition in terms of even auditing that we're going to have to face with. So if you do transfer money in terms of auditing principles to NSFAS, or if you do transfer money in terms of auditing to higher education institutions or to FETs, you've done your job and there is compliance on that. But it does not mean then that the actual outcome is what, in a sense, in the objectives, in the stated objectives of the department would appear to be. So I think that's really, there's that deeper issue here. And what I then suggest what we'll do into the future is start to analyze it. Otherwise, we comply, but it doesn't mean much in terms of the outcome. Because if we go to the public and say, look, we've done very well, there's a significant question to be raised. I'm just raising that beyond the actual annual report, and as I said, we've made the acknowledgement. There is a member, Makubele, that silently sits up there at the back. I really want to ask somebody in the department after this meeting just to speak to him. He actually led our delegation of higher education and training to Limpopo and Guyana in particular. And I really just want you to, there's certain things to be followed up. We are going to officially deal with that report, though. But I'm just saying that's a key individual. I think also in our discussions over the last while, the issue of RPL, now not necessarily from universities, one of those unfunded issues that has been raised, whether it's true or not, by the higher education institutions around it's in policy, but in terms of the way we institutionalize it properly, I just want you to take note of that. It's not really to get comments for now. But with that, members, we've received the feedback from the department. You were here for 2 days. We are always concerned after that you were last week at the select committee and next week somewhere else. So always like and actually away from office and being focused on real work and its reports. So even in our own system, it's something that we will, as Parliament and NCLP, obviously have to reflect. That in itself becomes a different discussion.
But with that, members of the department as well as the committee. Is it a burning issue? No, no. Okay, yeah.
I was in a way rounding, but I could see you rounding up. But one key issue we got earlier in the year, I think you will remember that yourself, Chair, was that often when the department transfers money to provinces, it does not always do what it's meant for. When provinces compile their budget, they are able to even either reduce that money and focus on other priorities in provinces. So it was an issue of who accounts to who, basically. And that issue was never clarified at any point. So it's possible that, like the example you gave, money is transferred to provinces, but the department, the DG in particular, may not always dictate what happens in terms of that money once it's in the province. So like you said, we may say in terms of the annual report, money went to provinces, but did it do what it was supposed to do in the provinces, and how that the department was hoping to, if it's resolved, if it could be assured that yes, it has been resolved. If not, because it's more a problem of even what treasuries in provinces do, and how do we pass that particular hurdle?
Thank you. No problem.
Just so, of course, the national department does not transfer any money to provinces except for conditional grants. All the other money flows by provincial treasuries, and of course we have no control or ultimately responsibility to report on those, but the conditional grants are really the powerful tool that we have, because that money only flows for particular purposes and we're able to monitor those very closely. So, Chair, just to clarify that, and perhaps just to say, yeah, I absolutely support what you're saying, but please understand we can only be held responsible in a sense for the responsibilities that we are given through our constitutional mandate, etc., and of course many of the issues are in a sense out of our hands. Chair, you're absolutely right. Good administration does not equate to good performance. But let me also say that I think the evidence of some provinces is that bad administration certainly does contribute to bad performance, and therefore we would argue that good administration is at least good for performance, but it doesn't, as you say, equate to it. It provides a platform, I think, on which the program managers can then do their jobs, and that's really what we try to provide. So thank you, Chair, and thanks indeed for this opportunity to engage with the committee.
Thanks a lot, members. Meeting adjourned. To the higher education and training, I really think we're going to deal with those issues of minutes and others at the next meeting. Yeah, because we are having SACWA next week. Thank you.